This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Today on Walter Edgar's Journal, we're featuring a public conversation between our guest hosts, Dr. Mark Smith and Dr. James C. Cobb, about South Carolina's economy during World War I. This conversation was recorded at the University of South Carolina's Capstone Conference Center in Columbia on February the 13th, 2018. It was part of a series, Conversations on South Carolina History, sponsored by USC College of Arts and Sciences.
Welcome. As you can see, and probably hear, I am not Walter Edgar. But he asked me to step in for him, and I consider myself to be very fortunate to be stepping in on this particular conversation, because it's an honor to interview one of my own favorite historians, James C. Cobb, who is the Spalding Professor of History at the University of Georgia. Let me say a few words about Jim. He really is one of the preeminent historians of the country and certainly of the American South. He's a former president of the Southern Historical Association, and he's written very widely on the interaction between the economy, society, and culture, especially of the 20th century South. He's written a bunch of books, and his most recent one deals with the American South since the Second World War, but his earlier work speaks very directly to the question that's going to preoccupy us tonight, and that is the First World War, South Carolina, and the economic implications of that war for our state. So Jim, welcome. It's a delight to have you. I'm going to begin by asking you a question that people usually ask me. I'm just going to ask it slightly differently. They'll ask me, you're not from round here, are you? And I say that I'm not. And then they ask me how, despite not being from around here, I got into Southern history. So could you tell us just briefly what inspired you to get into Southern history, to dedicate your professional life to the study of the South, and where are you from?
Well, I was actually born in Anderson, South Carolina, as most people who lived in and grew up in Hart County, Georgia, did, if they weren't born still at home. Anderson Hospital was where you were born, and if you lived long enough, you died. If you didn't die of something unexpectedly out on the road, you went back to the Anderson Hospital to die. So I feel as though I kind of grew up a South Carolinian, because we got, you know, all our TV came in the Carolinas. We read the Anderson Independent, which was, you know, it's sort of like, I don't know what contemporary reality show I would compare it to back then, but it was full of blood and guts, and there was no vehicle crash too bloody or no crime, no triple homicide too horrific for them to report on with gusto. But my mother was a tremendous influence on me in many, many ways. Not the least of them by any means was her interest in history. She was a voracious reader, and I was an only child living out in the country. And so in the summertime, I was plunging every year into our local reading program at the local library for kids. And I just read mostly history and got to be really absorbed with it. And of course, not in pre-adolescence as a sort of analyst of history, but just someone who just sort of consumed history, you know. And, the only way I could go to college, because my family certainly didn't have the money, was to accept a Georgia State Teacher's Scholarship, which paid you $1,000 a year for every year you agreed to teach in the Georgia public schools upon graduation. I started out teaching U.S. history, world history, geography, and English, and coaching the debate team at Loganville High School outside Atlanta for the princely sum of $6,000 a year. And at the same time, during the summers, I was trying to pursue a master's degree in history from the University of Georgia. And somewhere in there, all of that, I began to sort of figure out what the study and writing of history was supposed to be about. Ironically, since I held the Spalding Professorship, which was named for Finnesy Spalding, who was a colonial historian and a wonderful guy from a, you know, aristocratic family, and big mane of white hair swept back, incredibly handsome. But anyway, I just thought he was so cool that maybe if I became a history professor, I'd be that cool. And it didn't work out, but it inspired me to up my game a little bit, up my sights a little bit. And I sort of progressed from, I was interested in Southern politics. It was, back then it was still colorful. It was also awful, but it's still awful, but it's not as colorful as it used to be. But the more and more I fooled around looking at politics, I began to keep running across the economic forces that were behind it, and I sort of gravitated looking at the relationship between the economy and politics, and then the economy and race, and sort of realized that you really are not going to do justice to any particular subject in Southern history or any other genre of history without being able to understand the economic background, the economic platform for it. And so I've tried to when I've written about literature or music, I've always tried to think about economic context. And when I started all this, by the way, I was 6 feet tall and handsome. So you can see what happened. Then, it took a toll on me.
Well, Jim, I had hair before I started this, so this is obviously a condition of the modern historian, the price we pay for interrogating the past. I'm very glad this worked out because, frankly, there are relatively few historians who study economic history. It's fallen out of favor. And it is important precisely because it knits together all sorts of ancillary questions concerning literacy, wages, the economy, culture. And before we get into the specifics of South Carolina, I thought it might be useful to step back just a moment and think about the world in 1918 from an aerial perspective, economically. I think one of the seductions of history is for us to read the past through our present lens. And we tend to think it's probably very similar back then. But from an economic point of view, in terms of economic theory, in terms of the way that economies worked, 1918 was a radically different world to the world that we inhabit today. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if you look at Europe, where of course, by 1918, the war is winding down, but you see a lot of the same things you see in the South or South Carolina. You see this struggling between, the old ways and the new ways, the more hierarchical view of society and the suspicions of innovation and change. And so you get this process. It's not a linear process. It's not like, somebody discovers, here's a new, more modern way of doing this. Let's look for more modern things to do. And all of a sudden, everything is pushing ahead. It's a ragged, back and forth kind of process that, it's like World War I. They had hellish killing technology in World War I, but they're still using 19th century tactics. They're marching people out into a wall of solid lead and, getting them slaughtered. They've got massive killing capacity, but they don't know how to conduct warfare necessarily to utilize that in the most effective way. One thing we as historians always do is we tend to criticize historical figures as if they had our hindsight, and they don't realize this is happening to them any more than we realize, or in this maybe right now don't want to realize what's happening to us. But it's intriguing to see that. So if you look at the South and South Carolina during this period, it's just let's go this way. It's a little move in a new direction, and then there's a pulling back, and it's kind of like you could imagine getting whiplash with all the things that are changing and precipitously sometimes. But then you think, there's a breakthrough. Well, maybe not, because, 10 years later, there's still the same number of people farming as sharecroppers or the same percentage as were, or the same percentage of people working, you know, in textile mills at the same jobs that were there 10 years before, even though they've put new machinery in the mill and the mill might be more productive. It's a period, it is a period of flux and sort of uncertainty. And in Europe, the deal is how can Europe assimilate a rising, hard-charging, aggressive, militarized, modernizing Germany? And how can the old tottering empires that lag way behind already technologically and in terms of just where investments are made, how are they going to cope with it? And so in a way, it's like in the South, it's like how are we going to cope with this sort of invasion? Maybe it was a Yankee invasion, but this whole idea of all these, what Southerners viewed as Northern phenomena, like, you know, automation, like electrification and, the telephone, the automobile. How do we handle all this, and how do we rationalize it? How do we adapt to it? So there is a commonality there that I think it's interesting to think about, and maybe we can touch on that some more as we go forward.
Yeah, no, I think that's entirely right and very helpful. The First World War is a kind of global moment of change, and you see this reflected in South Carolina. I mean, if we look back, in economic terms, the world is barely recognizable from today. We had a different superpower, Great Britain. Now it's just Britain, not so great, but nonetheless, it was great at one point. And that First World War is really the beginning of the end in many ways, and the emergence of America, sort of stepping into an early vacuum. There's still a gold standard. Keynes has yet to write anything of meaningful consequence on deficit financing. So this is quite a different world. And in a way, that stage had been set for many years prior to the First World War. And that would also be true of South Carolina in a way, wouldn't it? Because some of the fundamental changes that people find in 1914 in South Carolina and the South generally, really beginning after the Civil War, what would be some of those fundamental changes that help set the stage for South Carolina's entry into the First World War?
Well, you know, I mean, the Civil War is such a transformative phenomenon in and of itself, not just in the South, but nationally. I mean, the Civil War sort of promotes this exploding of the gap, the economic and technological gap between North and South, because of the ways that the government, the whole Union fighting effort, so much stimulated an economy that was already kind of cresting into a new era in 1860. But in the South, what it does is it basically, of course, destroys the central economic system that was at the core of the social system. And it plays havoc economically in the developments that proceed directly out of the impact of the war are things that leave South Carolinians in many ways really, really vulnerable to some of these sort of whiplash events that they're going to encounter in the first two decades of the 20th century. There were something like, 400, I'm trying to think what the slave population was in South Carolina. It's about 400,000, as I recall, 1860. So, I mean, if we sort of figured that, you know, evening everything out, that the average slave might have been worth around $1,000. You know, you're talking about $400 million in capital that just vanishes. And that was the capital that was financing the economy. It was financing the growing of cotton. It was collateral that the planters were using to get the money to grow each year's crops. And suddenly, that is gone. The whole South is capital starved as a result. And, you know, banks are hard to come by. The national banking system's been reorganized while the South's out of the Union. Land is worthless because nobody knows if you've got any labor to farm it. So they evolved the whole system of the, in South Carolina and elsewhere, the crop lien, where the only thing you can mortgage is your crop. And it's not just any crop. You can't go get a crop lien to grow sweet potatoes, because your crop has to be immediately convertible into cash. So the whole idea that Southerners didn't have any more sense than to keep growing cotton when it appeared to be going in the tank. It was not just a matter of choice. They didn't really have any choice, because the only way they could get credit was to grow a cash crop. And all in all, tobacco being an exception periodically maybe, but they could make a whole lot more, stood to make a whole lot more growing cotton than any other crop, which means they have to give up. They have to give up self-sufficiency, because in the antebellum period, the whole approach to agriculture was different. The laws were different. You could graze your livestock just out in the open woods and fields, and you didn't have to necessarily devote grazing land to having beef or hogs. And so you could feed your family much more readily, and you could, do some services for a nearby landlord or cut him some fence posts or make some trade with a local merchant for the things you couldn't produce yourself. But they were basically practicing what some people call safety first agriculture. They were, I'm doing enough to make sure my family's fed, and then if I get a chance, I'm gonna grow an acre or two of cotton for cash. But you couldn't do that in the postbellum period nearly so well. And the railroads changed things, but the pivotal institution was the credit mercantile business that it didn't want to buy your fence posts. I mean, it's being supplied, out of New York or out of New England, and maybe the goods are actually cheaper per unit, but they have to be paid for in currency, and they weren't taking any Bitcoin back then, for sure. So what happens is your smaller farmers, all farmers to a certain extent, lose their self-sufficiency, and they are increasingly now forced to purchase foodstuffs and other things that they previously produced for themselves. And so the whole process devolves as landholding. It's so difficult to, because you imagine that the interest rates in a system where the collateral is an unplanted crop of indeterminate size or value, you're not going to exactly get bottom line interest rates. So it's very, very difficult economically, really at all levels of the system. And so you do find that there's a lot of foreclosure, a lot of people become tenant farmers on land, that they had either owned or somebody else's land, and they have even less recourse then to feed themselves. South Carolina passes a fence law in 1877 that up until that time, it was, if anybody wanted to protect their crop from livestock, it was their responsibility to fence the crop. Now you had to fence your livestock. So if you're farming, if you've got a little tenant plot, every acre is precious to grow that cash crop, and you have to really think about how many acres you want to devote to trying to feed out a hog or raise beef. It just sort of all kind of militates against self-sufficiency. I mean, agriculture drops down just simply in scale. Under tenancy, they start to count a tenant farm plot as a farm. So the average farm size in South Carolina goes from 1880 to 1910. I think the farm size drops from practically by half, or maybe by 1920 it has. So everything, the agriculture is on a much more tenuous, smaller scale. And so when they get hit by these dramatic plunges in prices or sudden drying up of markets, it hurts intensely, because they have just lost a lot of their independence and self-sufficiency that their parents may have had, even though the parents doubtless didn't have anything like, the cash income. So that has made the population, black and white, much more vulnerable. And, of course, there is a higher percentage of black people who are sharecroppers, tent farmers, than whites, although it's still high. It's, 60% throughout the period we're talking about. So, I mean, there is that. There is the fact that South Carolina had a contentious period in Reconstruction in terms of black-white political and physical conflict, but there'd been a steady kind of move to take the vote away from black people, which was achieved in kind of in two stages. In 1882, with a re-registration law and, you know, and a poll tax, and then in 1895, it was all written, you know, and extended into the state constitution. So you got, you know, well, you might have had 70% of adult black males voting in 1880, and you got about 11% voting by the turn of the century. And this means that they basically have lost any say-so in terms of their relationship to the state, the services that the state provides, you know, the schools, for example. Yeah, they, people used to say, well, it was really those Southerners were just so, white Southerners just so stupid. You know, they ran a dual school system and spent twice as much to educate the kids just because they didn't want to mix the races. Well, you know, people who go back and actually look at the numbers will tell you that's balderdash, because white Southerners and white South Carolinians starved black schools. A county with a black majority, when you started getting state appropriations, that was great to be a white kid in a county with a black majority, because you're spending a lot of money on your schools because they're starving the black schools. And, you know, like Dillon County, is sometime first decade of the 20th century, I think it was spending 12 times as much on a white pupil as a black pupil. So they, you know, they couldn't control that. They couldn't get the education that might have helped them gain a foothold. And in, you know, 1900, way over 50% of the adult black male population in South Carolina was illiterate. So there are all of these things that have sort of left people kind of unmoored and just sort of hoping something good is going to happen. And, of course, when it does, they react to it very exuberantly, but they have no control and no even, you know, I think very little conception of how quickly things can turn bad again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's entirely right. These crushing continuities from the end of the Civil War and really a reconfiguration of some antebellum practices after the Civil War. I forget where I read this, but there is an estimate that the actual cost of the Civil War in $1860 was almost directly equal to the cost of freeing 3.8 million slaves. In other words, had the South taken the exchange for compensated emancipation, there would have been a rough equality. The war would have cost nothing, and there would have been a compensated emancipation. But in the absence of that, counterfactually, we have exactly as you say, this crushing continuity. But there are also real differences, aren't there? I mean, don't new things happen in the early part of the 20th century that begin to set the South Carolina and the South on a different trajectory? And I'm thinking most obviously about industrialization. And of course, I have a particular dog in this fight. I'm not sure that slavery was a pre-industrial system. I thought it was quite industrial, factories in the field, and it had all the hallmarks of an industrial system, but because it's in a rural environment, people don't think of it in those terms. So when I say industrialization, I mean the conventional industrialization that most historians say, yes, it has factories, therefore it's industrial. That's an important departure point, isn't it, Jim, for the early 20th century?
Oh, absolutely. Once, you know, South Carolina is coming out of Reconstruction at the end of the 1870s, the conditions with farming and agriculture and the greatly diminished opportunity in agriculture creates a kind of a willing labor base. They certainly had, South Carolina had as much probably investment in antebellum manufacturing as any southern state, but the 1880s in particular see the rise of cotton mills. The textile industry has been ensconced in New England for a long time by then, but there's a game of catch-up going on there. And in the case of southern textile mills, so many of them, South Carolina in particular, in the 1880s were very, very small. The old idea that it was all these Yankees that sent their money down here to build textile mills, that comes later and done is not as big a deal when it comes as many people think. So they're building these mills based on a local, usually a pooled asset of a local community. You know, you're talking about people's life savings and maybe what's a little surplus that a church might have, or a you know, the Widows and Orphans Fund, or and so they're extremely risk averse. They can't jump out there to try the leading edge of what's going on in the textile industry. It has to be very, very rudimentary manufacturing, sort of first stage processing of cotton using, you know, totally raw, unskilled labor off the farm. And so the scale, there's expansion, and, you know, there are mills popping up all over the place. But the scale of those mills is, they're small scale, they're low value added, they're not turning tremendous profits. And there's a very interesting equilibrium going on that is, in some ways, may have actually held back South Carolina's textile industry's expansion, in that there's such a surplus of white labor available. Because, you know, the agricultural sector is shrinking in terms of demand, I'm talking about, and profit opportunities. The wage in the textile mills in the 1880s all the way well into the early 20th century is essentially pegged to the farm wage, because you only have to pay if you ever get short of labor, which they did. There was a real boom in mill building in the first decade of the 20th century, but there's such a huge surplus of white labor out there that all you have to do is pay just a little bit above the farm wage. And the farm wage in the South consistently lagged by a tremendous percentage, by, you know, 50 cents, say, as a daily wage, even the farm wage in the Northeast, and certainly lagged way behind the industrial wage, so that there's such a reservoir of labor that you basically go into the mill, and the only way to make it make sense economically is take your whole family into the mill and negotiate a family wage, which means, you know, women, children working in the mills, which creates an interesting dynamic when the you know, these impulses, a lot of women in South Carolina and a good number of progressive politicians, you know, were desperate early on to do something about child labor in the mills. But when they're trying to do that, they're basically going to cut the family income, because there's a family wage that factors in having child labor. So the industry goes through these growing pains to get there. But gradually, you build up a mill class, which is, if you're a native South Carolinian, you know, that was a class divide that was real. But you get a generation of people who have never farmed, say, and they get more and more separation from the farm. And in the 1880s, there was fluidity. They built a little mill here, and you go in there and go work, and it doesn't work out, you just go back to the farm. But you can't really do that by the early 20th century, because for one thing, you've forgotten how to farm, and, you know, there's nobody who wants you to come back to the farm. But gradually there is a maturity in technology, in the whole process of textile manufacturing, that the process is speeded up, productivity rises, and you see an interesting shift in the demographic of the mill workforce. It was Hale's great victory when they got significant child labor legislation in South Carolina, except the mills were more than ready to concede that, because by that point they realized that you know, relying on child labor was really an impediment to increasing productivity. The process had gotten so speedy and demanding. So you see a rise in male employment in the mills, a decline in female employment, and ultimately the disappearance of children. But it also is the textile industry has by 1920, it's reached a point where it means something that you spent your whole life in a cotton mill. You've acquired experience. You've acquired a sort of comfort with that kind of work, so that the mill owners do not want to, they don't want to lose you. They don't want to pay you anymore, but they don't want to lose you. And so you start to see, nonetheless, you see a separation finally between the farm wage and the mill wage. And You read about wage cuts in the mills, and they certainly were, but I'm betting if you really follow real closely, you're going to find they were mostly entry-level wages that are being cut because they simply didn't want to lose the skilled operatives who knew how to, could do two or three tasks in the mill and could do them expeditiously. So when you get to the depression in the textile industry after the war, and I mean, the 1920s are just a terrible decade for textiles and the cotton economy in South Carolina. But what they do is instead of firing or trying to cut the wages of the most senior workers, they cut their hours. And there's a great old kind of a novelty song called Cotton Mill Colic, and one of the lines is they'll run a few days and then they'll stand just to keep down the working man. So they either cut your hours or they also use these various processes that mostly fall under the heading of the stretch out to wring more productivity out of the same workforce and or even in fewer hours worked. And this, of course, sparks the textile unrest in the 20s and, feeds over into the 30s, and it sort of is a boon to union activity. And, of course, there's a gradual move in agriculture to mechanize. That's very, very slow in South Carolina. It really doesn't come until later, really boosted along by the New Deal, say. But there were these possibilities. And the war itself, introduces... Southerners or Southern leaders during the period from the end of Reconstruction up through the 1930s they're sort of gradually trying to acclimate themselves to the presence of the federal government and, basically an expanding presence in their lives. But they're also understanding that the feds can actually do stuff for you that's good. It's good for you and good for your state. The key is to keep them out of your business, particularly your racial business. And so, in Mississippi, the planters, the congressmen, they latch on to, they play the government like a drum to build new levees along the Mississippi River to, start real flood control. And so when the war comes and you get these, expenditures for camps, Camp Sevier at Greenville, and I don't think many of these things are around now. I mean, Camp Jackson obviously is, but the Charleston Naval Yard, they get this sense of this federal spending, it can be very, very beneficial. And this is where I'm pretty sure is born, I know it was in Georgia, World War I, the whole idea that, since we basically are sending the same people back to Washington all the time because we've disfranchised everybody who might vote against them, let's use our seniority and start directing a lot of this federal money down here, particularly the military money. So, I mean, that's the background of Mendel Rivers in this state, or Carl Vinson in Georgia. But they're starting to sort of see this as something you can cultivate, you can tweak. You got to watch the feds, And South Carolinians were more, they were a little more leery because Reconstruction had lasted much longer and they'd been troops in South Carolina longer. And so it took a little more getting used to. But the idea of sort of adapting to a federal presence and actually exploiting it was something else that comes to this period.
So your comments remind me of the old chestnut question that every undergraduate has to answer about wars. Were they an economic boon or were they deleterious? Did they hold something back? And of course, we're accustomed to think of wars as accelerating economic growth. I just looked up a couple of numbers before we gathered here. And on the surface, the numbers are staggering. Total farm incomes in South Carolina rose from $121 million in 1916 to $446 million by 1918. The value of textile production doubled between those years from $168 million to $326 million. These are enormous multipliers just within 2 years. My question is, Jim, is that really a reflection of the economic accelerant of the war or just how wretched things were in 1916?
Well, I'd say both. Cotton had enjoyed something of a comeback in the first decade of the 20th century, and if I remember correctly, I think in 1914 cotton was selling at 13 and a half cents a pound in South Carolina. And then, of course, with World War One, the British blockade the North Atlantic, which puts a kibosh on all our shipments of cotton to England or anywhere in Europe. And so 1915, the price of cotton drops by one half to 6.5 cents a pound. Then finally, as we move on the end of war, we get involved. Of course, there's more domestic demand for cotton and textile products, you know, for uniforms and tents. And then, of course, we can resume our trade with Great Britain. And so by 1920, the price of cotton has jumped up to 40 cents a pound, which was more than three times what it was in 1914. This is true for farmers all over the country. I mean, the government pushed everybody to produce to the max, plant as many acres in cotton as you can, and it paid off for a year or two. I mean, and it paid off very well. This was good enough so that even down at the very bottom of the ladder, the tenants were actually, you know, able to have some walk around money. I mean, they had money to spend, and it was quite a little infusion of energy into the South Carolina economy. But when peace breaks out, then, you know, nobody is around to say, well, here, what we're going to do is we're going to subsidize, we're going to give you price supports here while the price goes down. It was just thunk. So the price of cotton is 40 cents, its peak is selling 40 cents a pound in 1920, selling back at 13 and a half cents a pound in 1921. And textiles get into that same predicament because basically they have saturated the American market during the war. And after the war, you know, you simply don't have that need for the processed cotton to that extent. So that's behind this depression where they have to start the stretch out system and all of that. I think World War II you could make a better case for World War II being a bigger kind of long term boost to the economy just because of the sheer overwhelming amount of money, like $9 billion spent in the South. Defense spending in the South during the World War II. World War I was, our involvement was too brief, but this whole period, as I said a while ago, good stuff is happening. So here we are, let's go up, and then crash. Bad stuff is happening. It's sort of like you'd get whiplash. You need a neck brace to make it through this whole experience. But it's what's happening is, I think, change comes about. I'm not going to inflict it on you, but I used to force my students to listen to my model of what I call the turning period in Southern history, which basically starts about 1910 and runs through 1945. And you have so many things that happen that not necessarily, you know, all kind of line up into a trend, but they just shake things. They shake things loose. You know, you've got what we just talked about, the push and pull of the economy. You got the massive outmigration of black people from South Carolina, which has been going on before the 20th century, but you know, it really ramps up when World War I cuts off the flow of immigration to northern factories for jobs. Then suddenly jobs open up for southern blacks, and you get thousands of black South Carolinians leaving the state, which then, you know, puts questions about, what are we going to do about our remaining labor? How are we going to grow our cotton? And it creates all these, you know, anxieties for farmers, even though they're going around most of the time prior to that saying, I wish we could get rid of them, all the black people in the state. And then, you know, the boll weevil gets here, gets to South Carolina. It hits in 1922, and right on top, you know, you got the price of cotton going south, and then the boll weevil shows up and just rips into cotton production, so that you know, you got a massive drop in cotton production in 1922, and you have just in the space of a few months after the end of the 1922 cotton crop season, 50,000 black people leave South Carolina in like 8 months, just because it's just one thing after another, and if you're trying to hang on, you want to stay where you grew up, you don't want to split your family up, but it's just one kind of thing hitting after another. And so you get these compounding kind of shockwaves, and you get, you know, a great percentage of all farms in the United States were in a depression from the early 20s until the stock market crash. You know, they don't know what to do. Farmers historically react to rising prices and falling prices exactly the same way. They grow more because it's the only way they can keep their income up. So you know, it simply promotes overproduction of cotton, which of course is going to tank prices. So when the New Deal comes along and then jumps in and sort of stabilizes that, but further reduces the scale of Southern agriculture and the farm population, it creates another kind of surplus population that strike state and local leaders in particular as you know, we've got such a you know, underutilized population who are looking around to get on the dole and not doing anything, that I think it really accelerates their interest in actively recruiting industrial investment from outside the state. This is something that sort of catches hold in the 20s, and South Carolina and most other southern states come out of the 30s really intent on doing that. I mean, there were unions in South Carolina going way back in the 19th century. I mean, they were not really ever quite there to stay. I mean, they did well until they had to test their strength in a strike, and it usually was the end of them. And then federal presence during the New Deal sort of provided a little umbrella for union growth in the state in the 30s, but the state's political leaders and the economic development leaders, realizing that it's all those underutilized people who basically don't have much skill and are willing to work cheap, if you're going to get investment, that's what's going to draw outside investment. You know, it's not the high-tech laboratories that South Carolina has, you know, at that point, or the possibilities for developing technology that will create a whole new industrial revolution. It's basically cheap labor. So that is, I think, the root of this incredibly strong anti-union tradition coming from the top in South Carolina. People say, well, you know, it was people off the farm, they were very individualistic, and, you know, they just didn't cotton to these outsiders. Well, all that's true to a certain extent, but they pretty quickly also realized that they wouldn't be working very long if they did seem at all interested in what these folks had to say, and of course the state does everything it can to discourage a union presence. But that union activity was also part of this ferment, the to and fro, that kind of marks the World War I era.
So I think this idea of a turning period is very helpful, because it essentially doesn't allow us to identify one factor and one factor alone as causal. It's multiple things. Having said that, I think one of the real benefits of this conversation is to remind people who perhaps are not inclined to see either America or South Carolina as having any real relevance in the First World War, that there was relevance. I mean, far be it from me to speak from a European perspective, but there is a tendency in a continent racked by the First World War and the Second World War to often quietly discount the participation or the effect on America. And certainly that was much more obvious in the Second World War, but most Europeans, in the First World War, the Americans didn't really suffer, they didn't really impact them in any sustained way. But plainly, when you look at the South Carolina angle, it did have an impact. And part of this is because, you know, part of this conceit is that, you know, South Carolina is a very rural place still in 1920. I mean, we have, what, a population of 1.6 million people, and 1.3 million of them live in rural areas. So the assumption is, oh, they couldn't possibly be affected by this because it's not an industrial society. But they were affected in some important ways. And I think that your point about the cotton prices is absolutely right. The inflated prices as a result of the war, in a way, the war exposes the pre-existing vulnerabilities that you outlined at the beginning. All of the things, those crushing legacies from the Reconstruction period that made their way into South Carolina in the 20th century were in a way exposed by the war and then exacerbated, I think, in the 20s and 30s. Let me push you a bit more on this business of trade unions. Jim has a very interesting blog. He's a very talented writer and is well worth looking at his blog. But one of your more recent interventions has been, and I don't mean to take this up too far, but we are inheritors of our past. One of your more recent essays talks to the question of state sponsorship of economic development and trade unionism. And in a way, if I heard you correctly, the First World War has this kind of odd federal intervention, a state sponsorship of economic development, and the relevance of trade unionism. Is there some connection that we can make between then and now, or is that just a fruitless and dangerous task?
Well, yeah, I think if you look at unionism's expansion and recession in the first half of the 20th century in the South, I mean, you see it happens either in relative boom periods when the pie is growing so much that there's less inclination to quibble about how big everybody's slice is. Mm. And then, of course, when it comes back to crunch time, it's another matter. But I think that the unfortunate history of labor violence in South Carolina and in the textile belt generally in the 20s and 30s left a stigma that could be manipulated to associate labor unions with outside agitators or social unrest, social upheaval. And it was so easy then to pull the union. I mean, everybody knew, what a bunch of race mixers the CIO was. Your son would be working next to a black guy if they both joined the union. Or they were seditious. I mean, they were, everybody knows the union organizers were really communists at heart. And so it's so easy to manipulate that imagery. If you can swallow the whole inverted paradigm that we're going to make our people more prosperous by holding their wages down, you can accept the idea that obviously organizations that are dedicated to the progress of workers are contrary to our best interests. I just think the South had to learn how to be anti-union. It wasn't necessarily nearly as much of this sort of cultural thing that just these old boys off the farm didn't need any outsider telling them what to do. I mean, that was certainly there, but it's like my father. I mean, my father, when finally it was apparent we were going to starve to death if he didn't quit farming, in fact, it well past when it was apparent to me we were going to starve to death if he didn't quit farming, he did quit farming, and he went to work in a shock absorber plant. It was Monroe shock absorbers, which are came out of Monroe, Michigan, right, supply Detroit. The union organizers would show up and say, here's the check stub of the guy who does exactly what you do in this plant in Monroe, Michigan. And he'd look at it and he'd see, he was making half what the guy doing the job in Michigan was. But he also knew he was making a hell of a lot more money than he'd ever seen in his lifetime and had ever made on the farm. And he looked at it that way, this job is the key to a better life for my family, and I'm not going to mess it up. Because you could look, Roger Milliken had already closed quite a few textile plants by then when there was talk of unionization. Mm-hmm. So it was a reality. It was a lot less an emotional decision than it was a calculation of interest. It's not necessarily that all this propaganda was necessarily working, although the threats to close down a plant worked. And they did in the case of this most recent blog you're talking about, and they basically did with a huge Nissan plant in Mississippi. The veiled threats to close down the plant if a union was voted in. So there is this sort of growing tendency to sort of just associate organized labor with alien forces. And part of it, during the New Deal, what happens, of course, is the Democrats become much more oriented toward organized labor, but they also become more oriented toward African Americans. And one reason is that all these thousands upon thousands of black people have been leaving the South where they can't vote and moving to northern cities where they can. So they're constituting, and they're going to large cities which means they give you in fairly populous states that have lots of electoral votes that are worth courting. So there are certain roots here for the civil rights movement, but it's one of those kind of interesting intersections between a sort of sociocultural phenomena and prejudices and hard economic realities.
So Jim, you've given us a great deal to think about, and then it remains only for me to say a hearty thank you for a really fascinating conversation. Professor Jim Cobb, ladies and gentlemen. No. Thank you.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I know that I did because I listened to the conversation between my two friends, Mark Smith and Jim Cobb, about how World War I had an impact on the economy of South Carolina. We're not just talking about industry, which of course would be textiles, but also agriculture and the labor market. Women did come into the labor force in World War I. Agriculture became profitable. Textile mills ran three shifts a day. All of this war effort gave a tremendous boost to the state. And to that, you have to add the impact of the military bases in Greenville, Spartanburg, Charleston, and Columbia. While the war gave a temporary boost to the state's economy and the workforce, after the war, things slid back a bit. And by 1920, South Carolina was already in the Great Depression. This perhaps unknown story is also a part of our state's history. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.